Are you prepared to bug out? Infidel Body Armor and an Army Ranger have produced a high-speed DVD and book to show you how to drive in combat, patrol, and how to survive in combat. Skills you'll need when it hits the fan. Go to DrivenDVD.com. DrivenDVD.com. Are you prepared to bug out? Infidel Body Armor and an Army Ranger have produced a high-speed DVD and book to show you how to drive in combat, patrol, and how to survive in combat. Skills you'll need when it hits the fan. Go to DrivenDVD.com. DrivenDVD.com.
You're listening to Resolution Radio. Radio. ResolutionRDO.com.
Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. The time has come to stop focusing on what Trump, Biden, and all the crooked Republicans and crooked Democrats are doing as they try to grab the wheel of the sinking ship in Washington. Instead of what they're doing, let's talk about what we are trying to do. When I say we, I mean the men and women of the National Alliance. By we, I do not mean every racially conscious white person. I do not mean every dissident right Twitter user. I mean those who are serious about doing what needs to be done to save our people, and who have joined or supported the National Alliance. Today's program, based on Dr. William Pierce's seminal work, The Task of the National Alliance, will show you clearly how the National Alliance is different from any other racialist group, and why the National Alliance is different from any other racialist group, and why those differences are essential. There is no more important work than this one for those new to our message and our cause to understand. It has never before been presented in audio form. And so I give you the words of Dr. William Pierce in The Task of the National Alliance, Part 1. What are the factors which govern the priorities of the National Alliance and determine the nature of its task? We will attempt to understand, on the basis of present conditions in America, what can be done now and what cannot be done, so that we can see better how to concentrate our energies on those organizational objectives we can realistically hope to achieve. One fact of overriding importance should be kept in mind throughout what follows. The situation faced today by the National Alliance is historically unique. Very few of the classical conditions for revolution exist in America today, and therefore the classical expositions of revolutionary theory are largely irrelevant to an understanding of our task. There is, for example, no revolutionary class in the white population of America, nor a revolutionary consensus. And as we have explained before, the system of public opinion control, which functions in America today, the central nexus, makes it extraordinarily difficult for anyone without his fingers on the controls of that nexus to generate revolutionary sentiment. That is a situation entirely new under the sun. America is hurtling down the steep slope of racial mongrelization. National, cultural, and racial death lie in wait at the bottom of the slope. But the prospect is not one which rouses revolutionary fervor in large numbers of people. The level of abstraction is too high for the average person, who does not yet feel personally threatened. That will change somewhat as the press and clamor of the growing non-white hordes in America become more vexing and the economy worsens. Nevertheless, the relative comfort and sense of security, justified or not, of the average white American at this time cuts the ground beneath any strategy based on winning mass support for revolutionary action. What applies to the white masses also applies to the business, professional, and intellectual elements of the middle class. Most of the latter are better informed than the masses about the destructive processes at work in America, and there is a substantial amount of concern for the future among them. Nevertheless, their state of mind and their viewpoint are such that there is very little prospect of winning the support of a majority of them for a radical program at this time. The same conservatism and egocentrism which afflict the masses afflict them, although the maladies may be manifested in somewhat different forms in the two cases. The masses always have been and always will be essentially conservative in outlook rather than radical, whether they are supporting or opposing the government over them at any particular time. During the Vietnam War, for example, there was a great deal of talk, especially on university campuses, about opposition to the government's policies radicalizing the students and others opposed to continued U.S. participation in that war. The talk was sheer nonsense, as was proved when the whole so-called movement collapsed in 1973. Its existence had depended on the immediate irritant provided by the war, rather than on any demand for fundamental social changes. This editor participated in several of the largest anti-war demonstrations in Washington during the 1968 to 1972 period, mingling with other demonstrators and listening to their conversations and getting severely tear-gassed once for his efforts. Not only did the great majority of the demonstrators have no real understanding of the issues involved, but had no more radical an outlook than the average American. Even among the more violent demonstrators who trashed government buildings and assaulted policemen, no evidence of real radicalism was seen, except on the part of their Jewish leaders. There may have been more alienation, more irresponsibility, but very little commitment to fundamental ideas of any sort. The one thing the anti-Vietnam leaders had going for them was an effective organizational basis for their demonstrations and their propaganda. This organizational basis was staffed with capable and highly motivated cadres, and it allowed the Reds to accomplish a remarkable feat of subversion, even without a revolutionary consensus or radicalized masses. At the height of their power, they could put more than 250,000 protesters on the streets of Washington, and they could make it look convincingly revolutionary. There are other valuable lessons to be learned from the Jewish effort to use the Vietnam War as a revolutionary instrument. But for the moment, we are concerned with just two. First, the aforementioned non-radical outlook of the average white, even when a temporary situation exists which makes him amenable to recruitment for a revolutionary purpose. And second, the absolute necessity of a thoroughly radicalized cadre organization being already at hand if any useful action at all is to be gotten from the masses when such a situation does arise. During the Vietnam era, the left drew its cadres almost exclusively from the Jewish population, which constitutes a perpetually radicalized reservoir of manpower and leadership for almost any anti-white cause. An analogous reservoir of pro-white radicals does not exist at this time, either among the masses or among the more illuminated strata of the white population. These white elements, whose intelligence, sense of responsibility, and relative independence of the media lift them well above the level of the masses. The conservatism of the masses is mindless resistance to change and to new ideas. The conservatism of the other elements is more the inability to encompass ideas which lie outside a rather rigidly egocentric mental frame, an inability to rise above a conceptual basis which is constructed on outmoded values, an inability to visualize a wholly new kind of world, or to grasp the ethical concepts which must govern that new world and which transcend their own. And it is ultimately based on a lack of moral courage. Let us look at this latter conservatism. Let us trace its roots and see how it relates to the task of the National Alliance. Over and over again, one hears this argument. The National Alliance has a fundamental lack of goodwill towards blacks, Jews, and the members of the present political establishment. Without such goodwill, the Alliance cannot hope to achieve any kind of fair settlement of America's present problems and internal conflicts. Therefore, most white Americans, who are fair-minded and are people of goodwill, will not go along with the Alliance. This argument comes not only from TV-brained nitwits, but also from a great many intelligent, thoughtful whites. And it is, with a couple of important qualifications to be mentioned shortly, a correct argument. It is true that the Alliance has no goodwill at all toward the enemies of our race. The Alliance is not concerned with black survival, or Jewish survival, or Mexican survival, but only with white survival. The Alliance has not an ounce of charity for the gallows birds who make up the system currently governing America, and who have so shamelessly betrayed our race. It is also true that the average American is fair-minded, in a sense. He thinks in an individual-centered frame, while we think in a race-centered frame. He carefully distinguishes between good blacks and bad blacks, between loyal Jews and Zionists. We lump them all together, and that clearly is not fair by his standards. Implicit in the argument for fairness and goodwill are two major assumptions. One concerns the nature of the race problem, and the other, its solution. It is assumed that the race problem is one of street crime, deteriorating schools, declining military morale and efficiency, rising welfare burden, etc. There would be, from the viewpoint of the person making the argument, no race problem if all blacks obeyed the law, supported their families by honest labor, adopted a white lifestyle, and voted Republican, as some actually do. And the only solution of which a person with such a viewpoint can conceive is a negotiated one, a compromise designed to end the present strife and unpleasantness, a sitting down with black and Jewish leaders and saying to them, in effect, if you will keep your people in line, if you will reason with them and be reasonable with us, then we will bend over yet a little further backward for you. We'll work something out which will protect your interests as well as ours. Of course, such an approach to the race problem is not only based on the wrong values, it is an approach which must ultimately fail, as it is failing now, because the problem is a biological one, and it requires a biological solution, a fact which has been treated at length by National Vanguard. But the relevant point here is that the average American's mental frame simply cannot expand to encompass that fact and its implications. And at this point in history, the same is true of most unaverage Americans as well. Therefore, most Americans, including most intelligent and thoughtful Americans, will not support the National Alliance at this time. The divergence of viewpoints between the Alliance and the average American goes so far that many Americans are suspicious of our motives. They think the Alliance must secretly be a communist organization whose purpose is to make the country's problems worse instead of curing them. They reason, correctly, that any non-white who reads National Vanguard will become more hostile toward whites as a result, making a peaceful settlement all the more difficult. Therefore, they conclude, incorrectly, that we don't want a solution to the race problem. It is difficult to convince a person who believes the foregoing that he is in error, because our value system and his are entirely different. Nevertheless, despite the barrier to communication caused by this difference in viewpoints, the future is not so bleak as it may seem. The qualification made a couple of paragraphs earlier, at this time, is an important one. That is because the famous American fair-mindedness is a rather more tenuous thing than those who presently glory in it are willing to admit. The time may never come when honest Americans, even intelligent ones, will be able to expand their mental frameworks enough to fully encompass our view of the world. But the time will certainly come when their view of what is fair will change drastically. The fact is that white Americans like to think of themselves as fair-minded, as just, as humane. But the truth is that the great majority of them simply do not have the moral courage, which is a necessary concomitant to those traits. Consider, for example, America's entry into the Second World War. The masses, of course, were oblivious to what was going on, as always. But a great many Americans were not. Tens of thousands of journalists, of public officials, of teachers and professors, of leaders of German-American groups, of influential writers, knew the truth of the matter at first hand. They knew the true nature of the National Socialist Awakening in Germany, and they approved of it. They knew that something of the sort was necessary for a resurgence of the white race. And they knew that the Jews were behind all of Roosevelt's deceitful moves to get America involved in the war to destroy Germany. In particular, his maneuvering to bring about the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and enter the war via the back door, after his infamous orders to the U.S. Navy to fire on sight at all German vessels on the high seas, failed to provoke the Germans into a declaration of war. And in 1939 and 1940, many of those who knew what was going on spoke out. Even after the war started in Europe in September 1939, National Geographic, for example, carried unbiased reporting on Germany, despite the torrent of venomous Jewish abuse this policy caused to be directed at the magazine. While the Jew-owned Washington Post and New York Times shrieked about the German annexation of Danzig in terms of a brutal crushing of Danziger's independence under the hobnailed jackboots of Nazi stormtroopers, the National Geographic quietly pointed out in its issue of November 1939 that 93% of the Danzigers were Germans, and that the city-state had joyfully welcomed its reunification with Germany after the artificial separation imposed 20 years earlier by the Versailles Treaty. Well-known speakers, including aviation pioneer Charles Lindbergh, addressed huge public meetings denouncing Roosevelt and the Jews and the other war schemers. History, political science, and law professors at Yale and Harvard openly scoffed at the official government lies of German aggression and of Hitler's supposed plans for invading the United States via South America. There were even a few politicians in the Congress who were still willing to speak the truth as late as 1941. But as the Jewish economic and political pressure mounted, as more and more politicians were bought for the Jewish side, as the pro-war newspapers became shriller and more insistent, the fair-minded people who knew what was going on began to become more timid about speaking out. After the successful engineering of the Pearl Harbor attack, virtually all of them fell silent. Hardly any of them were brave enough to say what they all knew, that it was the United States, not Germany, which was the aggressor. Only a tiny handful, a few dozen, out of the former tens of thousands, continued to stand up for the truth, for justice, for humanity, for what was right. The rest fell into line with Roosevelt and the Jews. When the U.S. government announced that the Germans were boiling down babies to make soap, the thousands who knew it was a lie kept their mouths shut. When the United States began its policy of saturation bombing of German population centers in response to the hate-crazed Jews' demands that as many German civilians as possible be killed, all those white Americans who knew it was genocide remained silent. They not only remained silent, but most of them hastened to appease those they should have opposed. They joined the armed forces. They did volunteer work. They became even more, quote-unquote, patriotic than the warmongers, so no one could suspect them of being pro-Nazi. There were liberals, true pacifists, opposed to all wars on principle, who were more courageous in their opposition to the Jews than these fair-minded conservatives. When fair-mindedness became inconvenient, they abandoned it. When it became dangerous to stand up for justice, they accepted injustice. When the moral pressure to conform became sufficiently great, they switched sides and supported policies they had previously opposed. It wasn't just that they weren't willing to put their lives on the line for what they thought was right. They weren't even willing to put income or social status on the line. And it has always been the same. In World War I, the eminent British historian Arnold Toynbee wrote a jingoistic pamphlet for mass distribution in which he claimed that the Germans were bayoneting Belgian babies and cutting off their hands for souvenirs. He knew it was a lie, and he knew it would encourage British counter-atrocities against the Germans, but he didn't have the moral courage to refuse to do his bit for the British war effort. You've been listening to the words of the founder of the National Alliance, Dr. William Pierce, in part one of his foundational work, The Task of the National Alliance. Be with us again next time for part two, right here on American Dissident Voices.
You're listening to Resolution Radio, Radio, Radio.
ResolutionRDO.com.
My brothers, my sisters, I bring you a message of solidarity, a call to action, and a demand for adherence to duty of an Aryan resurgence and ultimately total Aryan victory. We have broken the chains of Jewish thought. We know not the meaning of the word mine, it is ours. Our race, the totality of our people. 10 hearts, one beat. 100 hearts, one beat. 10,000 hearts, one beat. We are born to fight and to die and to continue the flow. The flow of our people. Onward we will go, onward to the stars, high above the mud of yellow, black, and brown. So kinsmen, duty calls. The future is now. If months from now you have not yet fully committed yourself to the alliance, and you have in effect not only betrayed your race, you have betrayed yourself. So stand up like men and drive the enemy into the sea. Stand up like men and swear a sacred oath upon the green graves of our sires that you will reclaim what our forefathers discovered, explored, conquered, settled, built, and died for. Stand up like men and reclaim our soil. Kinsmen, arise. Look towards the stars and proclaim our destiny. Defeat never, victory forever.
We are the American Freedom Party. This is the most urgent time in the history of Western civilization. In the year 1900, white people of European descent comprised 35% of the world population. Today it is less than 9% and falling fast. Europe is being overrun with Middle Eastern immigrants, and America's founding stock is rapidly being replaced with third world peoples from around the globe. For the last 50 years, every influential institution in this nation, our schools and universities, our media, our churches and our employers have promoted policies and principles that teach whites to be ashamed of their great heritage and birthright. We, who in the 1950s, the 1960s, and 1970s were the world's dominant force, are now so afraid of being called racist that we were quailing towards irrelevance and extinction. Join the American Freedom Party today. Reach us at theamericanfreedomparty.us or call us at 701-317-5317. Paid for by the American Freedom Party.
Water is the single most important thing your body needs, so you want to be sure it's the best for you and your family. Since 2005, thousands have depended on Berkey Purified Water. The Berkey guy provides the lowest priced filtration systems in every size. For incredibly delicious water now and in an emergency, get to GoBerkey.com or call 877-886-3653. 877-886-3653. GoBerkey.com.
What would your life be like if you woke up each morning with new vitality, feeling better than you have in years, and you noticed a difference in your sleeping patterns, blood sugar levels, and had a sense of well-being overall? There's something that is changing thousands of people's lives, and you could be one of them. It's called Heart and Body Extract. Sharon Harris, co-creator of Heart and Body Extract, talks about the positive effects of Heart and Body Extract.
What happens with the formula Heart and Body Extract is it's giving the body the necessary vitamins, minerals, amino acids, enzymes, and phytonutrients so the body will heal itself. And yes, the body does have the ability to balance blood pressure, balance cholesterol, clean and unclog the arteries. It can also work on balancing the circulation for diabetics. So the body is an amazing thing. It simply needs some help so it has the tools to heal itself.
Heart and Body Extract gets results. To order your 2-month supply, call now, toll free at 866-295-5305. Order online at hbextract.com.
I believe in race. I'm not ashamed to admit it at all. And that doesn't mean one bit that I'm out to persecute or hurt any man because of his race. He can't help what race he is. We believe that each race has particular geniuses and particular faults. The white race has built white Western civilization, and we think the white race should dominate in that area. National socialism fundamentally is the application of science not only to inanimate objects and animals, but to mankind himself. We believe that the communists, the Marxists, have one fatal error in their doctrine, a place where absolutely there's a hole and there's no explanation for it. They admit evolution. They admit that animals vary by breed and that you can breed better and worse animals. Now, how do they explain how there is a sudden dividing line when you come to one particular animal called man? They have no explanation. Time and again, when I've asked them, they have no explanation. They just say, if it's got two legs and it stands on its hind feet, then it suddenly becomes a special being and there is absolute equality. They're all the same. Man is an animal just like all the rest of the animals. He's more intelligent, but he must obey nature's laws. And that insofar as he is an animal, he must obey the laws that pertain to animals. We say that when the white race has produced such a wonderful thing as Western civilization, we should treasure the people that have produced that and can maintain it. And we should not mix them all up with other kind of civilizations, whether or not they're good. We should certainly try to preserve it just the way the farmer preserves his better grade of stock. We are also, socially speaking, tribalists. You must live as social beings. You have to live with other people. And this is impossible unless you observe certain fundamental laws of the tribe, the ancient Indian tribe, any kind of tribe of people, even a wolf pack, has got to have certain fundamental things. One of these things is leadership. Not leadership by the most popular, but by the strongest and the best. Any tribe or Indian tribe or any group or family should be led by the best and the strongest. Otherwise, it disintegrates. It's got to have group pride and loyalty. You've got to have selection in the mating process, something that we have almost lost now. We believe that it is of fundamental importance to society that the strongest, cleverest, and the best of the men mate with the best type of women who will make good mothers. And when you destroy that machinery, you get what we have now. We believe that you have got to have an organic society. Now, by an organic society, we mean a society, not a dictatorship, but a society in which the parts of the society cooperate together in different functions and in peace and harmony, just the way your body works. Cancer is the wild, uncontrolled growth of cells at the expense of all the rest of the body, and that's what you have in Washington, D.C. right now. Cancer. We believe in private property and free enterprise. It is impossible, we believe, to have a society in which there is any real work going on unless people can get the reward of their effort. And at the same time, we believe you've got to have social justice. You cannot have people who are exploiting and squeezing little helpless people economically. And this is where I get in trouble with the conservatives, because most of today's conservatives, I've discovered, are reactionaries. They're real anxious to hold on to their money. They don't care how they have to figure it out. They just want those money bags. And they come up with any kind of rationale to keep it. Every National Socialist believes in idealism, believes in something that is worth more than his own one single human life. He's willing to die for something. When you're ready to die for something, then you're alive. And until you are ready to die for something, you have no real fanaticism. And just at dinner a little while ago with some of the fellows there, they said, were telling me, well, it's terrible to be a fanatic. Well, did you ever stop and think how this country got here? How all the great inventions ever got there? Any one of you out there that is not a fanatic on something or other, whatever it is you're studying, if you're going to be a doctor, be a fanatical doctor. Otherwise, you'll be nothing. You'll just be an ordinary old chug-chugging guy, and when you die, nobody will notice it. But if you're a fanatic, you'll produce something great. You'll create. Creativity is fanaticism. Every creative genius has had to be a fanatic. Many of them have been burned at the stake. So we are ideological and idealistic fanatics. Just like the communists, by the way. In between the Nazis and the communists is the great mass of non-fanatics. The TV watchers and the comic book readers. I will say this. National Socialism is the inevitable end product, logically, of evolution. If you believe in evolution, you've got to be a Nazi if you think about it long enough. You can't help it. But what happens is people short-circuit it. The minute they believe in evolution and scientific breeding until they come to that two-legged animal that stands up on its hind legs, then all the rules are up. We say that's not possible. You either believe in the scientific method and the truth, and you apply it to yourself without egotism, or else you don't believe in the scientific method and you're kidding yourself. Nazis believe in ruthless application of the truth, not only to inanimate matter and animals, but to you animals. People, all of us, are the same insofar as we are animals and must survive and live as animals. And unless we breed ourselves better, we're going to get worse. That's what's happening. I do worship nature in that I'm humble. When I see the mighty, awesome power of nature, and believe me, I've seen some terrific power of nature, the typhoons off Japan during the war, earthquakes. I've been through some tremendous cataclysms on this earth. And compared to them, the atomic bomb is like a firecracker, nothing. And when you start to think of the enormity of space, our spacemen are just going around at the very bottom levels. of space. There's no place yet. There are over 100 million planets where life just like here could exist. And in the face of that awesome probability, not possibility, probability, I say it's ridiculous to be egocentric and say we are the center of all things. Everything turns around us. We Nazis are humble. When I look at nature and realize how ignorant and small and feeble and weak and little we are, Nazism is a philosophy of nature, a way of looking at the world. And as I've pointed out, we believe in tribalism. We don't think we're above that. We think that you've got to have pride in your family, pride in your race, pride in your nation. That's not something to laugh at. Patriotism and pride in family and pride in race is something we should be proud of and cultivate, work on, not get rid of. Finally, we believe in morals. We believe in the traditions of goodness, virtue. Now, I told you something about what we are, but I'll do as good as I can in telling you what I think our enemies are. And our enemies, make no mistake about it, are the Marxists. The philosophy of Marxism, I believe, is the enemy of all humanity. It's the reverse of humanity. We say communism itself is the most vicious, antisocial doctrine the world has ever known, and here's why. They completely deny the very basis on which any human order can exist at all. Without humans, or at least without civilized humans, you certainly can't have human order. And the communists say they don't believe in race. They believe in absolute equality. The pygmies, the aborigines of Australia, everybody. Send them, let them all come to Carlton, and they'll all write arias and books, and the cannibals will be producing the music and verses. That's all you have to do is educate them. And this simply is not true. This results in chaos, social chaos, which is what we have now. They don't believe in enterprise. They don't believe that people should work for themselves. They believe that the state should come and tell them what to do. They don't believe in private property. They don't believe that you can keep the fruits of your production. They don't have, above all, they have no spiritual ideal. We say the only thing that's worth protecting with your life is ideals and your family, your race, and your nation. And twice in my lifetime, I've been called upon to go out and risk getting killed. And I saw a lot of other young men doing this. Young fanatics that they made out of us, by the way. They made us real fanatic haters of the Germans and fanatic haters of the Japanese. Nobody protested that that was bad to be a fanatic when we were fighting those Japs, and I assure you we all were. Finally, the communists, if you remember when they first got into our Russia, they are against morals. They had free love, no morals at all, everything was have a ball. And the result was they almost tore Russia to pieces, they just fell apart. Now, if you'll notice, they are almost puritanical in Russia. In order to make the thing work, they've had to go back to the very principles of tribalism which we're advocating. You can't work society with a communist pipe dream. Civilization is based on self-sacrifice, on the willingness of men to go out and die for what they believe in. When you get rid of that self-sacrifice, you get anarchy. Civilization is built because I am willing to give up something for my family. And the family is willing to give up something in order to have the town succeed. And the town is willing to give up something so the state can be in business. And the state is willing to give up something so the nation can succeed. Self-sacrifice is the first principle of civilization. Communism has got the fanaticism to destroy you, and it's doing it. And unless you can build up a counter-fanaticism for something you believe in positively, you will be destroyed. You are being destroyed.
Recently, there was a report out that among new babies that were born, this happened last year, minorities were now the majority, that whites were officially the minority.
And they're boasting about it. Khrushchev just said, America's so liberal, they'll never fight. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, but we're going to change that. It won't be quite so liberal. After we've had a chance to make America understand what it is and make it conscious of itself and its greatness and its people and the white race understand that they're worthy of protecting themselves, that they don't have to keep humbling and downgrading themselves while other races are standing up and saying, look at us, how great we are. We keep saying we're ashamed of ourselves for being white. That's a terrible thing. The thing for each race to do is be proud of itself. And the white people And the good people of this country, when they finally realize that they can do that without hurting or being obnoxious to anybody else, they will finally become fanatics to survive, to keep this great country going.